Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. What do rural voters want? It's a question that a lot of political consultants these days are asking because the voters of the America's Outback have a lot of power. And since Donald Trump won the White House in 2016 with the power of the rural vote, it's been a riddle that the news media has at least failed to crack. Why is there this widening gap between rural and urban voters? How could mending that be good for America? Our guests have spent a lot of time looking at the data, busting myths about rural America, and have come up with some answers that others have missed. We're joined by Nicholas Jacobs and Daniel Shea. They are the authors of The Rural Voter, The Politics of Place, and Disunited of America. And welcome both to The Source.
Thank you for having us, David.
Thanks, David.
Daniel, Dan Shea, tell me, what do you mean? What is, describe a rural voter?
Well, there are different ways to describe a rural voter, right? There's a more technical sort of where they actually live definition, and we spend a lot of time in our book wrestling with the different definitions of what might be a rural part of the country and what's not, with a small town versus a rural. But when it comes down to it, a big important part of this term, the rural voter, is a self-identification, is a feeling by the voter, by the citizen himself or self, that they actually live in a rural community. So there are really two different ways that you might define a rural voter. One is through census information and population densities and so forth. And the other is by simply asking the respondent, you know, where do you live? What's the type of community you live in? Do you live in a rural setting?
And why is it so confusing? Why has it been so hard to understand what rural voters want, Nick?
Well, why is it so confusing to understand what rural voters want? I think some of that has to do with the fact that it is very difficult to get data on rural voters, along with these definitional difficulties that Dan has spoken to. You know, that ultimately leads us to the fact that rural voters are a small portion of the American population and a small portion of the American electorate, about 20%. And so, although we are inundated with polls and surveys of what the American public on average is thinking on any number of issues weekly on how the candidates are doing, you know, in one of those polls or surveys, rural voters might just constitute, usually on average, a smaller percentage than they even should, just a few dozen of them in some even reputable polls. And we know that with small sample sizes, even though a point estimate is routinely given out about what rural voters are thinking, the margin of error on that estimate is enormous. And so rural voters can be thinking all sorts of things. And from survey to survey, from poll to poll, what's on rural Americans' mind? It's just so volatile. And that's what led Dan and I to really dive in and construct what is to date the largest survey of rural voters on rural issues to really figure that out, because existing methodologies, sort of where the money is in polling and major news outlets, you know, although they're a powerful part of the electorate, they just aren't been so important to understand in that way.
Well, it's kind of, when you say they're a small part of the electorate, yes, that's true. But Nick, when they vote, like in Texas now, 80% Republican, that's an important, powerful voting block that decides which way Texas is going to go, who gets elected, what policies are going to be put in place. And is that just here in Texas, or, Nick, is that happening across the country?
No, you're absolutely right. And I do want to emphasize, we can think about them being powerful because they are voting in such large numbers in the margins they are, right? That would be a form of political influence that is derived from the fact that rural voters sort of constitute this political movement. And that's what Dan and I really focus on, is that political development not an institutional story that really digs into whether or not rural voters are that much overrepresented in institutions like the Senate. And when you really do dig into that political story about why rural voters, when they vote in mass and in common in the way they do, it is a national voting bloc, and it's an enormous national voting bloc. It's a voting bloc that is more important for Republicans than the youth vote is for Democrats, than the black vote is for Democrats. It's almost equivalent. It's a little smaller, but it's almost equivalent to the importance of unions for Democrats. There's only really sort of one segment of the electorate that, you know, we sort of readily identify that is as important for the Republicans as rural voters are, and that's people over the age of 65.
So, Dan Shea, the rural voters, did they get together and decided, let's all vote Republican there, and maybe we can get something out of this?
Well, that's a great question. You know, we wrestled with that right at the beginning. We started to think that this was an unprecedented turn that we're seeing in our history. We wanted to be sure about that. So, you know, on top of this massive survey Nick was talking about, by the way, there's 14,000 respondents in our survey, we also pulled together one of the largest election data sets ever created. We go to the county level, every county in the U.S., all the way back to 1824, and we track this phenomenon. So the question is, have we ever seen a divide like this in American history? And the answer is no. There have been periods when the rural voter would side with one party or the other for an election or two, but it generally was geographic. It generally was regional parts of the country, right? But we don't see until really about 1980 this dramatic turn of rural voters towards Republicans. So we track it over time. We say it's unprecedented. We think it starts in 1980. So a big part of the book is describing this evolution getting us to where we are. It's a complex story, as you can imagine, David. There are pieces where we think the Democrats dropped the ball, where Republicans dropped the ball. To summarize it, we'd be glad to give you more details if you'd like, but to summarize it, there was a growing feeling that the Democratic Party didn't understand and appreciate rural culture, rural lifestyle. There was a sense that the Democrats no longer cared about rural America, and there were a heck of a lot of Republicans that were anxious to tell voters that the Democrats didn't care about rural America. A lot of sort of bottom-up pressures, real policy changes, the farm crisis, NAFTA, and so forth, but also a lot of down pressures from other politicians, think Ronald Reagan, Pat Buchanan, and so forth.
And you can see how there's a feeling that the city folk look down on the rural voters, and we see that in the media. We're going to talk more about that when we come back from the break. We're talking about the book, The Rural Voter, The Politics of Place and the Disuniting of America. We're going to get into the data. I think the data tells the story. We got to get away from some of these myths that have been handed to us that don't really stand up when you look at it, the aggregate of what's happening across America. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll take a one-minute break, and we'll be right back.
Support for TPR comes from La Fonda on Main, honoring the authentic cuisine of interior Mexico since 1932. Open for lunch, brunch, and dinner. More information at lafondaonmain.com.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line, having a conversation with Dan Shea, professor of government at Colby College. He's written or edited more than 20 books on American politics. Also with us, Nick Jacobs, a assistant professor of government at Colby College and a Goldfarb Center faculty associate director. Together, they've written the book, The Rural Voter, The Politics of Place and the Disuniting of America. So, Dan, what do we get wrong about the rural voter?
Oh, how much time do we have, David?
Just go for it. Just fill the whole hour.
Well, I'll start with our chapter. It's almost chapter by chapter. We tackle the big questions, and one that surprised me a lot was our social capital, our civic engagement chapter. There's this idea that rural communities are wastelands of alienation, where there are places that people want to leave but can't leave. There isn't a lot of pride. There isn't a lot of connection. There isn't a lot of community. That's not what we find at all. We find that rural Americans are proud of where they live. They want to stay where they live. They're twice as likely to say that they want to stay in their community. If given a choice, would you leave? They're less likely to say that, dramatically less likely to say that than people in suburban areas or urban areas. There is a sense of connection, of community, of pride that I think a lot of people don't appreciate. You know, we asked an open-ended question, describe your community. We asked this to urban people and suburban people and rural folks. And over again, we see these very positive descriptors of rural communities, more so than in other parts of the country. We've gotten that wrong. We've gotten it wrong that rural people, that they love where they live, and that's an important thing to understand.
Well, in the 2022, we had a race for governor in Texas, and Beto O'Rourke was the Democratic challenger against our Governor Greg Abbott. Beto O'Rourke had a deliberate strategy. He was going to run hard in the rural parts of Texas. He had rallies all over the state and counties, and just tried to really reach out and show that he cared and that he was going to come up with policies to directly impact and improve life in rural Texas. And he got less than 20% of the vote. He did worse than Wendy Davis did 4 years before when it came to these rural counties. So 20% of the vote in the rural counties. So it kind of like the lesson learned is, this seems like something that cannot be cracked if Democrats want to try to, this is the strength and the weakness of the Republican Party, the rural vote, but it doesn't seem like this is something that can be cracked, Nick Jacobs.
It is something that is very difficult to crack for any individual candidate. But what we are doing when we're talking about O'Rourke's campaign and where he's going out in the countryside and that single election cycle, like, we have to remind ourselves, and this is why Dan and I really take both an historical approach and a contemporary survey approach, right, that he's running up against 40 years, decades of history and growing distrust towards that label that he does not shed and he cannot shed. And I don't even think he really tried to shed, which is the Democratic Party label. That's a lot to expect or anticipate or want from any one candidate. And, you know, I'm not an expert in Texas politics by any stretch of the imagination. I'm sorry that I'm not. But when I also hear us talk about policies, right? He came to rural America. He campaigned in rural America, and he offered us a lot of policies. And the people didn't respond. You know, I also think, I'm not trying to excuse rural voters. I'm just trying to understand rural voters. And actually, when we're just trying to understand voters regardless of where they live, we do have to recognize, check ourselves that, you know, not all voters are thinking about policies all the time. Even the great listeners of public radio, right, are thinking about politics, not always with a list of policies that are going to, that they're going to vote for or that are going to serve their self-interest. A lot of the times it comes down to, does that person standing in front of me really understand me? Do they represent the group of people that I'm with, or are they representing the group of people and the interests and the community that over a long period of time, right, has stood apart from me and increasingly stood in opposition to me? I understand that the political lesson to maybe draw from that is to turn away from rural communities, don't invest the next time you have a statewide election and going to those places. For a variety of reasons, Dan and I come out strongly on the other side of that and say, no, if anything, we need to double down our efforts in rural areas. But I would emphasize those handful of things, right? This is a long history, and it's more than just policy. It's about an identity.
Well,
and, you know, if I say,
yeah, Dan,
if you don't mind, I'll just add real quickly to that. You know, it was a double-edged sword for O'Rourke because he, in some sense, his campaign was nationalized. I mean, he was a national figure. My students like Beto O'Rourke, you know. But if it's nationalized, then the national Democratic identity is going to come pouring down on him in those rural communities. Yeah. So,
well, I look at the rural areas and I kind of get it. I understand it when I go out and do reporting in the rural parts of Texas. I love going out there and talking to folk, and you see they're fantastic people, and you say, man, I wish I could live out here. But when you talk about there's a need to have deep roots in the rural area, you have to show that you are part of that place. There's a huge sense of place in the identity, Dan.
Yeah. Well, towards the end of the book, we talk about, you know, where are the cases, where are the places where Democrats are able to do well? Sometimes when, at the very least, do well. And what we find is those candidates have a deep, authentic connection to their communities. They are known. They can rise above that sort of nationalized label. And then all we know, Jared Golden, right? So we talk a little bit about the 2nd District of Maine is a Democrat. It is a red district. It votes for Donald Trump the last two times, and the Democrat, Jared Golden, wins. Well, how does he win up there? Well, he's known. He's known very well. He's an authentic Northern Mainer. And we see that in a number of places across the country. It's not impossible. The one piece that will override, we think, that long history of Democratic politics, the Democratic piece that Nick was talking about four decades, is an authentic connection to the community.
Let's go to a caller. We have Jody on the line. And Jody, you're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. My comment is that I feel like right now rural voters are maybe ready for some change. I feel like they had elected representatives to represent their interests. And with the school voucher issue, you know, the governor went after the people that they genuinely elected to for their genuine interests and replaced them with, you know, basically, like, I feel like carpetbaggers, like, you know, LaHood, you know, from San Antonio, taking over for Representative Allison now, and the governor's trying to push his agenda and not really caring about what these people want in rural areas regarding things like school vouchers, and speaking to your other point you were making about Beto O'Rourke, I think he did worse because he just ran for so many offices, for congressman, for senator, for president, and then he ran for governor. I think people just really didn't take him seriously anymore because he was like, he's just running for anything and everything.
All right, Jody, thank you for that. Appreciate that. So we have the Governor Greg Abbott primarying fellow Republicans in Texas who didn't support him with school vouchers. School vouchers not popular in rural Texas because the public schools are some of the biggest employers, mm-hmm. and they are an identity mentor in these areas, and they see school vouchers as a threat to that. So do you have any reaction to that, Dan Sheng?
Well, you know what, Nick? I just think Nick, he's got a thought on that.
Okay.
I'll follow, but go ahead, Nick.
I was just particularly interested in the tail end of that comment about how rural residents, and again, we bring data to back this up, how rural residents may have been reacting against, let's call it the political ambitions of O'Rourke, right? And I think rural residents are, I don't think they are unique in this regard. I think a lot of people in American politics, the electorate, is observant and keenly aware when a candidate comes to their community and pretends to be something they're not, or when a candidate is perhaps trying to trick them into thinking that they understand you and they feel your pain. And, you know, just to preempt a question that we always get, you know, I think when we talk about authenticity, it is absolutely right to raise the question, well, Donald Trump wasn't from rural America. How on earth could you call him authentic? And we don't. He's not authentically rural. He never pretended to be authentically rural. If anything, what he pretended to be was authentically against the political class. And I think that's where this comment of recognizing how some people thought about O'Rourke's political ambitions dovetails with a general sort of anti-establishment, deepening distrust towards the political class, broad feelings of resentment towards government that we do find as a strong motivation among rural Americans.
Well, some people say Donald Trump brought out voters who didn't vote before, particularly in rural areas, white men, uneducated men, and they're saying this is just a Trump phenomenon. Dan, do you see that, or is this wider and deeper?
Oh, we think it's wider and deeper. This trend that we're seeing that we started to see in 1980 will continue. It may turn eventually, but Donald Trump falls right in line with what we would have expected if with any Republican candidate. But there is one piece that maybe I could bring up about the sort of the mobilization of a new voter. What we find in our data is there is a small group of rural residents, make up about 10%, that are especially engaged. They're deeply connected. They're very loud and they're very aggressive. We call them the rural rabble rousers. They're the ones, to be honest, that are painting their barns and have lots of flags on their lawns, and they go to the town meetings. That's great. It's First Amendment stuff. But the problem is very often the media will sometimes turn to that group and imagine that all rural voters are like that. All rural voters are deeply, deeply connected, engaged, and fired up about every issue. And that's not what we find. When we separate the rabble-rousers from the other 90%, the other 90% seem pretty much like the rest of Americans, the rest of Republicans across the country. So when it comes to this mobilization, this engagement piece, I think it's important to pull out this one group of about 10%.
Are those 10% they're loud and they're vocal, or do they help define that community, Dan?
Yes, they often do, because they're the ones that show up, right? They're the ones that are at the town hall meeting.
And they're cinematic, so they show up on TV.
They sure do. You know, public radio does a great job, but we do call out reporters in general for relying too heavily on this group, because it is the flamboyant, it is the clickbait, it is the headline, right, that grabs our attention. The problem is that rural residents look at that and say, hey, that's not us, right? And non-rural residents look at that and say, wow, they're all crazy. They're off the wall.
Yeah, so there's like that Trump house in Pennsylvania that everyone –
Yeah, it's so funny because, yeah, I don't know if you noticed it in the book, yeah, we talk about the Trump house. Or CNN reporter goes out to understand what's on the minds of rural voters in Pennsylvania, and they go to the Trump house, a guy who's painted his house Trump colors.
So they're just talking to the nuttiest guy they can find, and they're learning about that guy, but it's not fair to try to draw anything more than that. So we're going to continue this conversation on the other side of this break. We're talking about the book, The Rural Voter, The Politics of Place, and The Disuniting of America. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
The EarthX 2024 Environmental and Sustainability Congress of Conferences is happening in Dallas, April 22nd through the 26th, bringing together all sides with one important mission: protect our planet. For info, earthx.org.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Rural voters are perhaps the most important voters in America because they vote as this bloc, and they certainly are the most misunderstood. What questions and comments do you have about rural voters? Maybe you can help us understand them a little bit better. You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We're joined by Nick Jacobs and Daniel Shea. They are the co-authors of the book, The Rural Voter, The Politics of Place and the Disuniting of America. And let's go to a caller, and the caller is Margaret. And Margaret, you're on the air.
Thanks so much for taking my call. I am so glad you're doing this study of rural voters. And my question is, do you have any data concerning the power brokers within counties who have so much influence over how voters vote in those counties? And we've all heard the story of the Duke of Duval, and I grew up in a rural county, and I knew from a very early age, you know, where to look for the power brokers. And I'm just wondering if you have any direct data about how influence is organized within rural counties to direct voting. Thanks.
Margaret, thank you for the call. Who wants to take that one?
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't, but I do think you raise a really great point about where to look for influence and how politics is thought about and discussed within rural communities. And it relates to our earlier conversation about policy and identity. I mean, so you're thinking about power brokers in small communities. It might be made up of a few hundred people, families that have been there for a long period of time. Everybody knows everybody. This is not unlike the communities that Dan and I actually live in as two rural residents ourselves. And in that type of an environment, right, politics is deeply personal. And it's not in a different way than it is, I think, in other types of communities where we know that politics can be a much more privatized affair. People talk about their politics. People take cues from one another. And in that way, a lot of what we see when we're talking about margins for Trump or a Republican candidate in the 80% range is we're talking a lot about a sort of social confirmation bias, where people, even if they don't like a candidate or if they had the time to actually look at some policies, may come to the realization that those policies aren't for them. As a community, they sort of march in lockstep together. And I think that's very related to this sort of pride of place that Dan spoke about earlier. It's related to what we write about in terms of how rural residents think about the economy in a sort of very different way, in a more communal way, rather than how the economy is doing for you in terms of your personal finances. So I'm sorry I don't have data on that particular point. But I, to the extent that it's reflective, like you asked the question because like you know how politics is working in your community, I can validate that through our study.
Dan Shea, did you talk to any of the Democrats who are rural voters, and why are they cutting against the grain?
Well, they're there, and unfortunately, we did find that they're reluctant to be especially vocal and especially overt in their partisanship. In some communities, they are not anxious to put out their yard signs or put on the bumper stickers. Like Republican voters, they have deep concerns about the direction of their community. One of the things that we talk about towards the end of the book, and it's related to Margaret's question and Nick's answer, is that this is really important. What's important is not that Democrats do better per se. It is that there is viable two-party competition throughout the country, right? We end the book making a case for competition, for a balance, right? So the one of the issues that Margaret raises, I think if there was a viable two-party system in those counties, in those communities, you'd less likely to have these power brokers. So it's not a prescription for Democratic candidates, but it is a plea for Democrats to show up so that other Democrats can feel good about turning out, about putting yard signs out, about being visible in their communities. And in the end, public policy will be more balanced. Public policy will be more pragmatic, to be honest. You'll get to some solutions that everybody feels better about when we have this viable two-party system.
Well, and Dan, the criticism has been made that the Republicans are benefiting quite a bit from the rural voters voting as a bloc, but yet they are not really delivering in terms of coming up with public policy that benefits a rural America, and there are a lot of needs. Poverty hits especially hard in rural America, and in Texas, health care in rural America is just not there. There's a lot of needs out there, but you know, why is there a disconnect? And I wonder if we could flip the script. There's always this accusation that Democrats take the black vote for granted, and therefore they don't do enough for African American communities. If the same thing can be said for Republicans when it comes to the rural vote.
Well, let's slide back to the last answer. So, what we suggest is one of the ramifications of one-party dominance is an over-reliance on symbolic issues, right? Issues that play to the base, issues that are very attractive to a particular wing of, in this case, the Republican Party. Now, it might be also true in urban areas for the Democratic Party. And what you don't get is you don't get pragmatic solutions that are more centrist. You get appealing to the far side, right? You get a very different set of policy discussions than you would if there was a viable two-party system. So I think that explains part of it, is that they're appealing to the far right because they're the ones that turn out in the primaries. And the general election's a foregone conclusion, right?
Yeah. Let's go to a caller. We have Sean on the line. And Sean, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I've lived in a lot of rural communities. I'm 57 years old, but I have seen that, like, especially like in Terlingua and Marfa, when you were talking about rural communities, there are these, you know, steadfast conservatives that have been there for generations and generations, and the new folks that move in are much more liberal, and they seem to just get along just fine with the hula hooping and fire tossing and the guys that are shooting AK-47s out on their private property. And it's just fascinating to me that works out there. And I was just wondering if y'all could comment somewhat on that.
All right, Sean, thank you so much. You put some hope in my heart. Don't do that to me because that could hurt. But so let's go to Nick. Nick Jacobs.
Well, yeah, I mean, it reminds me, as I mentioned earlier, Dan and I live out in rural Maine, and, you know, our neighbors and friends out there think we're a little squirrely for doing so. Well, the first thing I'd like to think about, right, the political divisions that are so on display, and this is to Dan's point about the rabble-rousers, right? Not everybody out in a rural community is thinking about politics 24/7. You know, there's other things that keep them up at night. And I just like to stress that because even if they're voting differently than you might want, right, I think that they're thinking about a lot of the same issues as liberals living out in the countryside or as conservatives living in the city. And what Dan and I repeatedly find throughout the book is that there's a lot more common ground on a lot of things than you might anticipate. And that when we structure everything around political divisions, who do you support, who do you not support, right? Our politics, our political system forces people into a binary choice, right? You have two options more or less when you show up on election day. But even if somebody, you know, the conversation invariably is like, well, why'd you vote for Trump? They could be voting for Trump for a variety of reasons. They could be voting for Trump because they do not want to see increasing levels of immigration. They could be voting for Trump because he is so far removed from the political class and people are so resentful towards government that he's there. He is more with them than the other side. And so I do find that when, you know, and I've heard from people around the country, when you go out into the countryside and you actually learn a bit, when you don't just tourist there and stay at the nice bed and breakfast and go apple picking on the one afternoon, but actually embed yourself in the community, you know, after a while, people do open up and want to talk to you. And I find the same thing in cities, too, when I travel there and look like a fish out of water.
So what's an opener that would help do that? You come up to somebody and say, why'd you vote for Trump, or what do you do?
Yeah, don't be a journalist going to a diner saying, hey, was your vote for Trump because you're a racist or because you're poor? Right? Like, and that was the dichotomy that was handed to us after 2016 to make sense of rural voters, not like, tell me your history, tell me your story. Why do you love living here? What if you could change something, why could you? You know, these are the questions that, quite frankly, you know, Dan and I can't ask on a national survey, and that we only get insights from because we do live those lives, and we share it, and we talk to people from around the country that feel similarly about these things.
All right, taking another break, 1 minute break. We'll be right back, continuing talking about rural voters in America. What do they want? How can giving them what they need, actually help heal America? The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. It's The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The Rural Voter, The Politics of Place and the Disuniting of America is the book. We're talking to the co-authors, Nick Jacobs and Daniel Shea. So, Daniel, there is this idea that there is a feeling of resentment, even anger, rage, I've heard about in rural voters. Do you see that too?
Well, we don't suggest it's rage. We think it's a simmering resentment. There's a feeling among many rural Americans that their place that they love so much and their neighbors that they care so deeply about are in trouble. Right? As we've said, we all feel anxiety in America today, right? What I've said is double that and take it back a few extra decades. That's the rural anxiety. That's the rural resentment that we see. They're convinced. Now, some of this is perceptual. I'm not saying it's factual, but it is perception what matters in politics. And some of it we might very well spring from both Democrats and Republican policies, right? We talk a lot, for example, of NAFTA. NAFTA was both a D and an R policy. It decimated manufacturing in rural America. We talk about NAFTA ghost towns, for example. So there is a lot out there. There's a lot of blame to go on each side. But one way or another, many rural Americans have come to believe that their world is in trouble and that nobody's paying attention.
And is that really the concern, Nick Jacobs, that the rural America feels that the rest of America, urban America, ignores them or thinks of them in a negative way?
I think that hits a major part of it, right? So I think there are material concerns. Rural America is poor. Inequality in rural America has been built for generations now, right? So we just started talking very seriously about inequality in the last decade as a country. You actually look at the numbers, inequality has been as high in rural America since the 1970s, a lot of that driven by federal policies and land management, agriculture, mining, et cetera. The employment opportunities are just not there and not as diverse, although rural people, I think, are just as entrepreneurial as urban people. There are structural issues that matter in terms of the rural economy. But yes, I think you have to understand that those material issues sit alongside these other symbolic considerations about what, you know, I'm raising two young boys in a rural community. I'm cognizant all the time of the signals that we send out about what their value is and what their lives mean in a changing America, about where the energy is, where the dynamism is. You know, you had a presidential candidate, quite frankly, that celebrated the fact that she won the Left Behind places. It's not cool to be rural, they're told. And, you know, I love it, warts and all. And so these cultural symbolic considerations are right alongside these material ones, and you can't separate them out. And those that try to separate them out to give you a simple story that, oh, well, it's people voting against their self-interest. Ah, they're dupes. They don't know the policy. It's all rage. You know, it's people, even rural people contain multitudes.
This idea that, and I do hear it from some people saying that the rural voter is voting against their own best interest. They're voting for candidates who support policies that actually will hurt the lifestyle, quality of life, and stability for people who work in agriculture and who are in rural areas. And, I mean, far be it from me to try to guess, you know, what's in someone's best interest and why they vote one way or another. But, I mean, so Dan, but they do seem to be voting, at least in Texas, for people who are not giving them health care, who are not going to support policies. The Biden administration with the Inflation Reduction Act is spending mightily in rural parts of Texas. They're pushing rural internet subsidy funds to provide internet for rural parts of the country. You do have to wonder if they are voting against, in a practical sense, their own best interest, Dan.
Well, there is that piece, and you surely can lay that out. You can lay out a set of policies and match it up with the demographics of rural communities, and you might say these would help these people. And that's fair to do that. I teach a seminar on rural politics. My students did that yesterday. That's part of it. And one of the other pieces is that, unfortunately, in many of these rural communities, there's no Democratic official that can make that case, right? There's nobody there. There are no Democrats able to spread the word that Democratic policies would help. We see that with the infrastructure development, right? There's nobody in these rural communities who says, hey, you know, this came to you from Joe Biden and the Democrats, right? It is Republicans quietly taking this money and building roads and bridges. But there is a third piece to it. And the third piece is that rural voters have a general sense, right? And as Nick was saying earlier, they may not focus on specific policies, but they feel they have a general sense of where each party might take them and might reflect on their communities in the long term. And they've come to see the Democratic Party as being indifferent and maybe even part of the problem. Now, I think the Democrats are frustrated with that, as you suggested, David. I mean, there's a lot that they're doing. There's a lot that Joe Biden is doing. But that's hard to shake. It goes back 40 years, as Nick was saying earlier. It's more of a general feeling and sense. Don't think for a second that voters are hyper-focused on specific policy questions. There are cues and there are notions and feelings that are very important part of voting behavior.
And so, Nick, there's also the negative trope that people have that people who live in rural America are misinformed, underinformed. We do see a crisis with local news hitting rural parts of America. Do they have access to good information about news and politics?
Well, and as it relates to what we were just talking about and whether or not rural communities, right, or rural people have the mental bandwidth or knowledge to vote in their self-interest. I mean, I see no difference in that type of political or policy knowledge when you're showing up to the voting booth. Just to quickly reflect a little bit more on that before I get to the question you posed. I mean, just point the question in the other direction. Can I sit here
and come up with a thousand reasons why a liberal Democrat in a city is voting against their interest in terms of, you hear it all the time from the other side, right? Voting for policies that increase the debt, which over the long run is going to jack interest rates up to a point that's not sustainable, right? Voting for policies that are going to continue to concentrate wealth among, you know, you can do the same thing, but that would be shouted down as wrong. It never is shouted down in the reverse, in my opinion, because it needs to be, because it is making assumptions about what is in people's self-interest and how they understand policies. Now, as it relates to news and news consumption, what we find is that rural Americans are, in fact, the least likely group to follow the news regularly, and they are the most likely group to say that the news that they do hear about, mainstream news, is irrelevant to their communities. So what you have is you have a crisis of journalism in rural communities that isn't so much sending rural people, you know, into their basements reading conspiracy theories, because conspiracism is no higher in rural communities than it is in urban communities. But what it is leading rural people to do is sort of drop out of mainstream news, just not follow it to begin with. I'm sure one could come up with an argument, I'd be sympathetic to that argument, that does make candidates like Donald Trump more appealing, but I think it makes it more appealing not because there's some lack of knowledge, but because, again, trust in another institution, this case mainstream media, is rock bottom.
Daniel Shea, do Republicans worry about losing the grip on this voting bloc that's so important to them?
I don't think so. I don't know where the cracks would be. You know, I do think that the Democrats are rolling up their sleeves. We're hearing of outreach programs in swing states, at least. I know that there are governors, the Andy Beshears and Gretchen Whitmans of the country, that are doing better in rural areas. They might look at some of these places and say, what's going on here? They're making some inroads, but it's going to be a tough slog for Democrats. I'm not too sure where Republicans are all that worried at this point. I think maybe they should be, but not at this point. I don't know what you think, Nick.
Yeah, so Nick, what do you think?
I agree with Dan. I think your comparison earlier in the program was a bit right, and that's why, again, just to make the fine point, this is not a partisan book. Dan and I, one of the best parts about writing this with Dan was that we disagree on a whole bunch of stuff, you know, when it comes down to sort of policies, and but we agree very much that our system, our political system, only works when both parties show up, because it creates that political pressure and those dynamics to hold elected officials accountable, to get them talking about the issues we want them to talk about. But that's how representation works in this country.
Well, at the very least, we should encourage folks to live in the cities, urban voters, to have more compassion for the rural voters. They want good things, too. Let's figure out how we can work together. I appreciate their book, The Rural Voter, The Politics and Place of Disuniting of America. Nick Jacobs and Daniel Shea, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, David. Nice chat.
And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.